All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Tim, I feel like we should start today with Near My God to Thee. Quentin Tarantino's not doing the movie critic. He's going back to the drawing board for his last movie.
Yeah, big news. The self-imposed last movie. And I guess he's putting too much pressure on himself. He didn't want to do movie critic. He wants to make the perfect last movie, which will be tough for him, because the other ones that were in the running, I think, were the Star Trek movie and like a Kill Bill sequel, which can't see him doing that. He's going to have to come up with an original premise, I think, but might have to wait a little while longer for that.
Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the hot-button war drama Civil War, which you can now see in a theater near you. I have been very much looking forward to seeing Civil War and chatting about it, considering it's about journalism, modern American politics, and it's a movie. So it's
there you go. It covers the Venn diagram that is Adam Donaldson.
That's right.
It's right it covers, in the middle.
It covers all my bases. We're going to get to that in a sec. Civil War is a movie from A24, which is this little upstart studio. It started about 12 years ago out of New York. And it has kind of quickly and maybe quietly, not so quietly, become one of the preeminent little studios, in, at least in terms of like these prestige movies. We're talking about a studio that's... fostered talent like the Safdies, Ty West, Ari Aster, Greta Gerwig made Lady Bird for A24, Kelly Reinhart, Sean Baker, Alex Garland, who's Civil War we're talking about this week, Rose Glass, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Love Lies Bleeding, like Sofia Coppola's, you know, migrated there. Both of the Coens, though they're working separately. Just, you know, it has been Noah Baumbach, of course, Darren Aronofsky. It has just been this, I don't know, vacuum of talent, over the last few years, and Civil War is kind of the ultimate expression of that. It is, the biggest film that A24 has released to date. So we're going to start today's show by talking about, and it's a long list of potentials, some of the overlooked gems of the A24 collection. A lot of movies I forgot, actually, and I like them a lot, but they're A24. So this is a studio that's cranking out stuff at a pretty good clip and a lot of really good stuff. And, you know, when you're putting in a lot of good stuff, a lot of it gets overlooked.
For sure. Yeah, and on their website, you can see they have a good list of all the films they've been involved with. So,
Yeah, we're talking about small movies, bigger movies, docs, horrors, dramas, comedies.
Undefinable.
Undefinable, that's right. Oscar winners. So it is quite the mashup. They're doing great work. And so we're going to look through the back catalog and celebrate A24 a bit this week. So, Tim, you go first with your first pick for an underappreciated A24 release.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. So, yeah, really interested in this topic. Like you said, a lot of great films A24 has produced and distributed. And I was looking, and I was like my favorites are like Lady Bird and Uncut Gems, but I wanted to go more like you were saying with the, instead of the uncut gems, more of the underappreciated gems.
Oh, well done.
You like that? I wrote that down.
Well done.
So there's some films on here that didn't do that well at the box office that I was looking at that I've seen, and some of them I've seen recently. So first on my list is Showing Up by Kelly Reichardt.
Yes, that almost made my list. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw this early in 2024. It's a film, like if you described it to somebody, it's like not a lot happens in the film,
No.
but it's so true to life, and you're invested so much in the characters that I was entertained throughout the whole film. And it's so low key. And it takes place in Portland with this artist, Lizzie, who's played by Michelle Williams, who's a sculptor. But she has to, pay the bills. So she works as an arts administrator assistant to her mother at the Oregon College of Art and Craft. That's taking up a lot of her time. So she realizes she has to take Tuesdays off to work on her sculptures. So we watch her while she does that. And, anybody involved in the creative arts will know, you need time for that away from the day job. So it's interesting following her doing that. And then also following her relationship with her landlord, who's played by Hong Chow. And landlord's name is Joe. And she's landlord neighbor rival artist to Lizzie. So it's weird. It's like they're friends, but there's this weird tension between them as well. She has a cat as a pet, and the cat maims a pigeon, and she just throws the pigeon out away. But Joe collects the pigeon, tries to nurse it to health, and has Lizzie take care of the pigeon. So it's one of these things where the cynical person, Lizzie, is forced to take care of this pigeon, but you can tell she grows attached to it. She's a really closed person, even though she's an artist. You can tell she's very closed, yet you can see her open up throughout the film, and it's a very natural progression. So it just follows her while she's trying to create her art, and there's this hope that, this mover and shaker artistic person from, I think it's from New York, is going to come see her show, when she has her show, with her sculptures. And it's just very like slice of life. This could really happen, not really accentuating highs or lows. This is just how she's going through her life. These are the obstacles she faces with her family life, with her art, with having to commit to a job while she wants to do her art. It's really a really an interesting film to watch, and I feel like all the performances come across as authentic. And it's definitely something that I'm sure didn't do that well at the box office. I don't think there's gonna be clamoring to watch it, but it's something when you see it really has an effect on you. So I definitely think that Showing Up is a film to watch from A24.
Yeah, you get really wrapped up in it, surprisingly so. You kind of have to really seek it out too. Like I sought it out because I love First Cow so much, and so when the new Kelly Reichardt movie, I was like, oh, I got to see this Showing Up. And it doesn't sound like much when you read the plot description, but you get really, really engrossed in it.
Yeah, and Kelly Reichardt too. She wants to be under the radar, I
I think
think,
so.
because originally she's going to do a biopic of Canadian artist Emily Carr for this, because Emily Carr, I guess, in her life spent 10 years as a landlord, and she neglected her artwork because she was so busy focusing on being a landlord. But Kelly Reichardt and her team were coming to Canada to research it. And while she's getting her passport checked, gentleman checking her passport said, "Oh yeah, Emily Carr, we learned about her in school." And then Kelly Reichardt's like, "Oh, she's too famous. We can't do a movie about her." Where like Emily Carr is not like uber famous or anything, but Kelly Reichardt was like, "We can't do it. She's too famous for our under the radar film here." So
Too famous for Kelly Reichardt. Yeah,
yeah,
it's funny.
exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah.
My first one is kind of an under the radar kind of slice of life thing. It's from the earlier days of A24, so it's, I think it was 2013 this came out. Spectacular Now, which is from James Ponsold, and he did Smashed and The End of the Tour and a couple other things. It's a coming of age drama with Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley. They play a pair of high school seniors. Miles Teller is he's smarmy, but he's likable and talented. But he spends all his time drinking and partying. He wakes up on the front lawn of Shailene Woodley's character one morning, and they start this friendship, and that leads to this romance. And they both have a lot in common in that they're both not sure kind of what they want to do with their lives. Both have these kind of overbearing maternal presences in their lives. Absentee fathers in Shailene Woodley's case, because her father passed away from an opioid overdose, in Miles Teller's case, because his father was a drunkard and he was kicked out of the home and told never to come back. So they have these traumas and difficulties and inconsistencies, and it's common. The difference is that Shailene Woodley's character is kind of a good student and is interested in comic books and nerdy things, and is walking the straight and narrow. And very slowly, the Miles Teller character sort of starts capturing her up in this whirlwind of his drunkenness and his sloppiness. And what's I mean, it sounds like a real sort of like after school special, but that's not kind of how it is. It's like this very like how unintentionally self-destructive we can be. And it's about like how the Teller character, you know, he does have genuine feelings about Amy. He doesn't know what to do with them. He's obsessed with appearances, but I mean, he's a sloppy mess himself. He doesn't really care much about his appearance, but he cares about how he looks. There's a scene where he works at like a men's clothing store, and the boss calls him in and says like, "Hey, I like you. You're good with the customers, but you're completely undependable. I have to downsize." He had the boss has like two helpers, including Miles Teller. He's like, "You know, if I want to keep you, but you have to stop drinking." And the Teller character gets up and is like, "Well, then I quit," because he can't give up the drinking, because it's the crutch. And it's just like, it's so mad. It's so heartbreaking, because here's somebody who's like clearly trying to give him a hand up, and his reflexive reaction is like, "No, I'm good. I'm gonna wallow in my misery. It's all good." And it's only till it's all about watching this character hit rock bottom and essentially be rejected by everybody, including people he kind of thinks are beneath him, like the Shailene Woodley character, that he kind of starts to realize just how messed up he is and how he doesn't have to be that way. So it's a really compelling movie. And you know, you have two very likable stars in Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley, and you also have Mary Elizabeth Winstead in it, and Brie Larson and Jennifer Jason Leigh. So it's a really good cast. It's a small movie, but it's a really engaging movie. And it's really hard to think of another movie like it. So it, Spectacular Now is an early sign of good things to come from A23, or A24, I should say.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. That just shows so many movies that are under the radar from them and across the board. You'd never hear about it again when it's sort of those slice of life, realistic portraits, right? Especially if, like, high school. You know, high school can often be like, you know, exaggerated and stuff, right?
Yeah,
So,
that's true.
yeah.
All right, that brings us to our number two picks.
Yeah, my number two pick, I actually spoke about it on the show before, but I thought I would reiterate. I think it was in my best five one year. It's Come On, Come On, directed by Mike Mills. There's a lot I liked about the movie. Well, I really loved the movie, but there's a lot that probably goes against it from a box office perspective. So why it'd be under the radar? It's a black and white drama film. And it stars Joaquin Phoenix, and Joaquin Phoenix is playing normal in this movie. So he's
Yep.
actually like comes across as a realistic person.
Big stretch, big stretch.
yeah, which you know, nowadays not so much like when he played Napoleon and he put his own spin on it. I know Brian Cox came out recently, the famous British actor, and said, like, what was he doing in that movie? Like,
That's
I would
right.
rather play Napoleon and have me play Napoleon. But in this, Joaquin Phoenix is I think he's brilliant in this film, playing a middle-aged radio journalist, who his job is he's traveling around, he's on an assignment to interview children about their lives and what they think the future holds for them. So we get some really good audio and good scenes of him interviewing children. They were non-actors, asking them questions about their lives. What do they see? What are they concerned about in the future? What are they hopeful for? And has an added level of authenticity because one of the co-stars is actually a radio journalist who starred with Joaquin Phoenix in this. Joaquin Phoenix's character's name is Johnny. He is, yeah, he's traveling around. He's actually in Detroit, and he talks to his sister Viv on the phone, and Viv mentions that her husband, her estranged husband, is going through some mental health issues, and she needs Johnny to look after her child Jesse, 9-year-old son, while she takes care and w her husband Paul, and they're over on the West Coast, so she's going to go to Oakland, all the way from LA to Oakland, all the way up the West Coast to visit Paul, and can Johnny take care of Jesse, the 9-year-old, while this is taking place? And what we have from there is just some great relationship sort of drama. There is some comedy in there too, but mainly drama focusing on the r relationship between Johnny and Jesse. And Jesse, you know, he has issues, obviously. He's thinking about his parents' separation, his father's, you know, mental health issues. So he has some problems he's dealing with, and he wants to continue on with Johnny as Johnny's, well, Johnny has to get back to work at a certain point. Johnny has to, you know, go keep doing the radio interviews. So Jesse ends up coming with him. And it's just a really good, it really shows a relationship so well between the two. Johnny sort of starts off as sort of this reluctant mentor, probably, for Jesse. And then he does show him sort of the ropes and what he does. And it's just really, really sweet movie. Really, I think the relationship, it reminds me of like Dustin Hoffman with the child actor in Kramer versus Kramer. It's just like, you know, they're together, you know, in that movie Dustin Hoffman's this workaholic and now he's finally spending time with his son. And in this, you know, Johnny's this uncle who hasn't really spent a lot of time with Jesse and now is learning about his nephew, and they learn from each other. And I really feel like the role of Jesse, which is played by Woody Norman, I felt was one of the best like child acting roles I've seen. I think he just plays it with such intelligence, plays it like a real kid but with intelligence. And I it's one of those ones again that's like plot point, not a ton happens, you know, they're not suddenly attacked by a dinosaur or something, right? But it's like this is just sort of like a real life story, and great job by Joaquin Phoenix in this. I don't mind when he, you know, he plays these out there roles, but I feel like he could come back to Earth every now and then.
He
He
could
did
be
in
more
this
normal. Yeah.
one, and he's very charismatic, very sensitive, very flawed, and I really enjoyed watching it. So I'd say come on, come on, watch Come On, Come On. It's really good. From A24.
Okay, cool. That's the one I haven't seen. In terms of stuff we've mentioned on the show before, this is from one of the very earliest episodes of End Credits, A Ghost Story, which is David Lowery's movie about this couple, Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. You never really ne learn their names, but the Casey Affleck character is killed in a car accident, and he ends up haunting the house that he and Rooney Mara lived in. Casey Affleck spends most of the movie wearing a sheet, looking like a Halloweeny ghost that you might see at the store buying your Halloween decorations. So it is inherently a little goofy, but it is very introspective. It is very melancholy. You watch as he, is observing his now former wife, she living, him dead, how she gets on with her life. She eventually, starts seeing other people and moves out, and other people move into the house. He's still there. A family moves in. The kids start to like feel his presence, although there's never really any interaction. And you're wondering, what's gonna happen? Are like people gonna interact with the ghost? They're gonna feel his ghostly presence. And sometimes that is the case, and other times, he's just there. He's literally the specter at the banquet, and time goes on, and it feels like as a ghost, he is there on this property to like the end of time, until time rewinds, and he actually goes back in time to before the house was even built. And then is going through that process again, and what you're sitting there wondering is like, okay, it's kind of like the most dull version of like spectral presence, like the afterlife is like, is this your fate to be a ghost and just to be like on this piece of land until you like fit, and like nobody comes to help you. There's no Clarence to come and to offer you insights. Maybe you look across the alley and there's another house there with another ghost, and that ghost is trying to, and you like, you can't help that ghost. That ghost can't help you. So it's like really kind of like, I don't know what. It just, you kind of get entranced by this, like just the melancholia of, what being a ghost might look like. The gross limitations of ghost life. So I don't know, it's strangely hypnotic. You never know where it's going as you're watching it, and it's just it's really something else. Like apparently this is an idea David Lowery had for a long time, and David Lowery is somebody who does is very much like still of the like one for them, one for me aesthetic. Like he made Pete's Dragon, the remake of Pete's Dragon, so that he'd have the money to make Ghost Story. So it's really quite something that, A24 gives some of these directors just the opportunity to do some of the craziest things, even if they don't seem crazy. But Ghost Story, it's unlike anything you will see. Let's just put it that way.
Cool. Yeah, that's like A24. That's great that they push the boundaries like that, right?
Yeah, for
Like,
sure.
yeah.
All right, that brings us to the last picks.
Okay, my last pick is Red Rocket by Sean
Oh
Baker.
yeah, another one that almost made my list. Yeah,
Yeah, 'cause this movie is a wild
it's wild.
this is a wild movie, yeah, and it's in Texas City, Texas. So the environment's really interesting too. This refinery town.
Yeah.
Just a small refinery town. I didn't know there was a Texas City, Texas, but there is. I believe it starts with this bus coming, like this Greyhound bus coming into town, and you see Mikey, played by Simon Rex, all battered and bruised, coming off of this bus back into town. And then the story unfolds, and it turns out that he's a former porn star who hasn't been back in town in 17 years. And he's coming back because his life totally fallen apart. He's like destitute, nowhere else to go, coming back to this town. And he goes back to live with his wife, who he's still married to. He's been estranged for years from her. Tries to weasel his way into living back with her and her mother.
Yeah.
And eventually he does weasel his way back. Because the thing is, Simon Rex in the lead for this is so charismatic and energetic. And you could see how people would be sort of drawn to his BS almost, right? Very selfish person, and but very entertaining at the same time. He's just such a selfish individual that, like, to celebrate, they decided to go to the donut hole, this little donut place, which I guess is a real, I don't know if it's called donut hole, but it's a real donut shop they filmed at. He goes there, they get whatever the, I forget what pastries they get or whatever. And then he notices 17-year-old girl Rayleigh, who goes by Strawberry, who's standing behind the counter, and he's immediately infatuated with her. And it, you know, very sleazy. He's infatuated with her. And then he starts up this conversation with her, asking her if he can sell pot in the donut hole in the donut shop. And she says, yeah, it'd be a perfect place, because these guys, once they're done working, these hard hats, once they're done working at the refinery, they want to kill themselves. So perfect place to sell pot. So he starts doing this, and then he ends up in a sexual relationship with this 17-year-old girl, and he's trying to groom her to go back with him to Los Angeles to become a porn star, and then he could, like, live off of her earnings kind of thing. So
Really, really seedy.
it's very seedy, but it's like there's no apologies, it's just complete seediness. And then there's this other neighbor, Lonnie, who just this younger guy, so he's kind of impressed that, oh, you're a porn star, tell me all these stories, all these adventures you had, tell me about it. And then it's just weird, the different, like, moral parameters each person has, because Mikey is like, I'll tell you all about it. And then I think they go to a shopping mall, and Lonnie acts like he's an army veteran, I think to get money. He's begging for money. He's like, saying he's an army veteran, and that just pisses off Mikey. He's like, you can't do that, considering all the things Mikey does. Like, I'm selling pot, I'm sleeping with 17-year-olds, I'm a porn star, but you can't say you were in the army. That
But stolen valor is too far.
yeah. So, and there's this car accident that Mikey's really responsible for, yet he's able to skate out of that as well. Strikes you as a guy that, like, should probably do, like, hard time or something,
Absolutely.
just so he could, like, know the consequences of his actions. But he's always able to sort of skate through, but he skates through at like the bottom of the barrel kind of thing, right? Even when he makes all this money selling pot, he ends up losing that because of his actions. But he's got this fantasy, and then it ends on this scene that's very strange. It's like, is this a fantasy? Is he fantasizing about this at the end? I won't give that away, but he's just, but it and it really shows the environment well. Sean Baker does an amazing job. I know that's sort of his forte too, showing this sort of this grungy, yeah, refinery town, and you feel like you're in it, and you could understand how things would function in that town.
Yeah, it's
And
so down to
even,
earth, but it's so elevated too. It's kind of weird. It's how it goes together.
yeah, and Mikey riding around on his bike, and then I think he tells him he has a car. He tells her, I think he tells Rayleigh, "No, I've got a car," but meanwhile he's riding around on his bike all the time. Yeah, it just shows sort of like desperate, delusional, selfish people in down in Texas. It's a strange movie, very strange, and
It's a strange movie.
I would recommend it though, 'cause I like strange movies, and good for them for doing this, even though it's very wild. And it won some very interesting awards. I forgot there's even a dog in it, but Sophie the dog won the Palme d'Or award.
Very prestigious, very
Yeah,
prestigious.
but it did. But that prestigious, it's in the t it was a top 10 film from the National Board of Review. Los Angeles Film Critics Association gave the lead actor Simon Rex their top award. National Society of Film Critics runner up. But then my favorite award, Alliance of Women Journalists Most Egregious Lovers Age Difference. Simon Rex and Susanna Sahn. It was just nominated though. It didn't
That's a
win
shame.
that.
That's a shame.
Yeah, so
I mean, it's one of those movies that kind of, sometimes studios like, we're going to release it at the end of the year in a few theaters, make it award eligible, and then put it out in January. It's going to catch on, and sometimes that just doesn't go according to plan. But I mean, I think Red Rocket is on Hoopla, which is the Guelph Public Library streaming service. So if you have a library card, you can go and rent Red Rocket right now, and I would highly encourage everyone to do that. For my last pick, I did another one that we reviewed on the show, The Black Coat's Daughter, which is a horror movie. It is kind of a haunted house movie. It's interesting because it's kind of an anti-holdovers in that it's also about kids left behind at a boarding school over winter break, except it's a girls' school and the characters are young women, and bad things happen because they don't leave the school. It's a, as I said, it's kind of a haunted house drama. It is kind of an exorcist drama. It's got Emma Roberts, Kiernan Shipka, and Lucy Boynton, who are all three great young female actors. It, also in the interest of spoiling and in interest of time, I don't want to get too much into it, but it is does have this disjointed narrative. It's like three segments, each from the point of view of one of the main three main female characters. And it is a bit unconventional, like a lot of these sort of like possession movies. Like, it really does invite you to suggest to really consider, like, is the person possessed? Is it all in their head? What's really going on? It is kind of really effective, really down to earth, really gritty. It has this kind of like, I mean, I'm sure it was digitally shot, but it has this kind of grime on the stock that makes you feel, really makes you feel like you're watching something from the 70s, even though I think it is set in modern day. But The Black Coat's Daughter is really worth seeking out as a horror effort from the A24 gang.
Nice.
Speak, yeah, no, and speaking of horror, we're gonna get into Civil War in a second. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Help you folks? Just looking for gas.
Gotta look the fuel permit.
No, we're actually just passing through.
Can't help, sir.
Sir, if we pay.
I was never gonna give it free.
Over the odds.
What's over the odds?
300. For half a tank and two cans.
300 buys you a sandwich. We got ham or cheese?
300 Canadian.
Okay.
Okay, that was a clip from Civil War. It's the new film from writer and director Alex Garland, and it stars Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Mora, Kaylee Spaney, Stephen McKinley Henderson, Nick Offerman, and Jesse Plemons. Maybe doing his best work since Game Night, I think. Interesting to
Who's
note
that? Who's
that
that? Jesse Plemons?
Jesse Plemons, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen Game Night?
No.
Oh, it's good. It's a good time. I completely forgot until I was listening to something else about the Civil War. Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst are married, and the one scene they are in is maybe one of the most intense scenes of the film.
Yeah.
And it's so it's sort of funny watching them almost literally on opposite sides of this thing and in this scene that I kind of this is the thing, we're walking a very fine line with this movie because there's so much to talk about, but there's so much you can spoil as well.
Yeah.
One of the
But
things I will so sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say the funny thing with that scene is Jesse Plemons is uncredited.
Yeah.
So I guess the actor who's supposed to play that role bowed out just before.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny that Kirsten Dunst said, "Oh, I've got somebody that's right for this role."
I
I
have
live
the
with a
perfect
psycho.
person. Yes. That's no, that is funny. You oh, I'm sorry, you need a last minute psycho?
Oh,
Well, imagine.
Jesse Plemons. Let's go.
Wait till do I have the person for you? Yeah, no, okay, one of the things I will say right off the bat is if you're going into this movie thinking that Alex Garland has something very important to say about politics at this minute in American history, you're going to be incredibly disappointed because I don't think Alex Garland, having listened to a few interviews with Alex Garland, I don't think he knows or cares about the nuances of American politics right now, and that
No, especially
there's.
since Texas and California got together in this
I
film,
was gonna
right?
say, since there's no way in hell the state run by Gavin Newsom and the state run by Greg Abbott would become strange bedfellows in any situation, no matter how drunk they get. But yeah, so I think once you kind of make peace with that, I mean, and it is provocative. There's a lot of people in the United States talking about civil war. It's an election year in the United States. A movie about a civil war in the United States called Civil War comes out in an election year. It's very easy to draw those lines, but what I think is like sort of once you erase those lines and just like take Civil War as its own thing, I think it is very, very good. It's not perfect, but I think it's provocative in just the right ways.
Yeah, I think it's provocative. I probably liked it less than you did, and I can get into the reasons for that, but I can understand where it's like from the journalist's eye and sort of like objectively documenting what's happening. And when such egregious stuff's happening, what does it even matter what the ideology is behind it, maybe, you
Yeah.
know, like this is their job is to just like as you know, Kirsten Dunst character says throughout it, Lee Smith is her name. She says throughout it like she's just there to get the picture, right? And there's that scene where a couple men are being tortured and she's like, "Let me get your picture in front of them." She sort of diffuses the situation by
Yeah.
let me get your to the
Yeah.
torturer, let me get your picture in front of
Yeah.
them. And it's all just like getting the perfect shot. And if I was to get shot, would you take a picture of me? And everyone's like, yeah, they're all just like in it for the content and in it for so I can understand that. I felt like, you know, and it's probably best that he didn't really get into politics that much, really,
Yes,
like into the details, or else this would become some even bigger topic on like Fox News and CNBC and stuff, and it'd just be all like, oh, how could he do this or how couldn't he do this? But I feel like I needed a little bit more background. I felt like with the president, like I guess he's an authoritarian president. They mentions that he's in his third term. It just sort of like subtly mentioned some things. Oh, that he did drop bombs on his own people or something. You just get the subtle, but you're not. I feel like there needed to be more so you could understand how this sort of revolution, this, you know, the Civil War is taking place. Like, why is it happening? I could have used some more context for that. And
I
then I
yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
And I feel like, well, you go ahead, because I was going to talk about something different.
Okay. No, yeah. Well, I've heard that critique, and I'm part of me is like, yeah, like it would be interesting to get more details, but like some of the details, I feel like Garland oscillates between like being very specific about the times. Like there's a line about how the Nick Offerman president has disbanded the FBI, which is something Donald Trump would definitely do. And the first scene of the film where he's like delivering this speech about how, you know, they're going to have the greatest victory in the history of mankind. I mean, that is such a Trump line if mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
And then there's other things like there's a scene where Kristen Dunst and Kaylee Spinney are talking about like the Antifa massacre. And I'm like, I understand like you've put two words together that are meant to provoke something, but like were Antifa massacred or were they doing the massacring? Because like, I got to tell you, I know people who identify as Antifa who talk about their cats and call them fur babies. And those aren't people who do massacring.
Yeah. So that's maybe like trying to do both sides, right? That's trying to.
It's very like he's trying to be specific and he's trying to not be specific. And just like, I feel like if he goes into too much more detail, what I think I appreciated about the lack of detail is just the idea that civil wars are just fluster cucks. And, you know, there's more than one side to this. There's the Western forces, which is the Texas-California alliance. We also hear about this Florida alliance that's never firmly explained what exactly that entails, although we do see one scene like guys in Bermuda shirts and flak jackets who I assume are the Florida alliance people just from the uniform. So I think, and I heard this from an interview with Garland where he's like, you know, the American Civil War was very clear. There were two very clear sides. But in a lot of places, most places, civil wars are just like these explosions of chaos where you have multiple factions. Some are good, some are bad, some are really evil and ugly, and people who are just like using the chaos to just be their own little chaoticians. And I think he's just like, he's saying like, this is chaos. This is like what chaos would look like if a civil war to erupt in the modern United States. Cause I don't think there would be like two easy sides. And yeah. I think it's very much from the point of view of like, what effect does this have on the people, especially the people whose responsibility is to cover this. And there's a line where Kristen Dunst is talking to Stephen McKinley Henderson. And she's like saying, I was doing this for years, going to these awful places, documenting these terrible things to send a warning back home. Don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
what happens when it's in your own backyard? And you have to bring all, because it's easy to cover something when it's not your backyard. And it's easy to be dispassionate when you are not invested in the outcome as a citizen of that place or as a resident of that place. What does it look like when you are invested in the outcome? And how do you bury all those things in order to cover the story the way it needs to be covered? You have to be dispassionate. You have to be there as people are killed. You have to show people what the brutality of it looks like, what the human stakes are. And it's hard to bring emotion into that because, you know, as we kind of see at the end, what happens when Lee lets emotion in? I think that, again, it depends on your point of view. And I completely understand people are watching this going like, yeah, but why? But I don't think Garland as a filmmaker cares about why. He's like, this is what this looks like. And
yeah, I feel like if there was just a little more why or a little more, like, I know he subtly mentions a backstory or, you know, my family lives on a farm, Lee says, in Colorado. And Jesse says, my family lives in a farm in Missouri. And
yeah,
so you've got little bits there, but I just felt like the violence happened so quickly and so often that I felt like I needed to know more about the characters to be truly invested in it, almost, you know. But I know it's almost like the point of view of the film is to try to be, I think, trying to be like dispassionate about it. Like you're saying, like the objective of your journalistic, you know, role here is to capture this. And this is, you know, horrific things, but this happens in civil wars around the world. So let's, this just by having it in the United States is meant to be shocking. You know, this is happening close to home, not millions or thousands of miles around the world or whatever. But I felt like it just, for me to be truly invested, like even the scene with Jesse Plemons in it. I guess because I had seen the trailer and I was expecting almost even more from that, right? And Jesse Plemons isn't in this movie long enough for me because the guy plays psycho so well. Like, in Breaking Bad, when he played like Todd the Nazi, it's like, wow, this guy, he's like nice to your face and then he'll like slit your throat. It's just like crazy, this guy. And I felt it could have used more, but I guess it was written as a sort of minor role. He came in last minute. He's uncredited. And even the way that's executed, pardon the pun, for that scene, I just feel like there could have been more, even the way it's executed, it could have been more tension drawn from it as opposed to, okay, this, and this, you know, here are you, you know, where are you from? I just felt like the tension didn't build, like, you know, like Inglourious Basterds, right? That's classic Christopher Waltz. The tension builds in that scene. In this scene, it's like I felt more could have come out of it. And so for me, and then sometimes because I didn't have the context of the characters as much or what the situation actually was, the violence wasn't that affecting for me until I would say the scene that got me the most was in Washington, D.C., and then when they go into the White House. And that might be because I'm bringing that to my mind because, you know, I think of the White House. I'm like, wow, they're actually in the White House having a firefight here. But it just seemed, and I guess I had, at that point, I had learned more about the characters. So I was like more invested at that time. But earlier on, it seemed like very episodic. And I know that's the chaos of a civil war, right? It would be episodic, but it's like,
it's also what Garland does. He does breaks down his movies into these episodic structures. So
yeah. So it's like episode, but not knowing by the end, I think I had known enough about the characters and then also the situation that really, I found it riveting what happened in Washington, what happened in the White House. But then that left me at that little bit where I would have liked to know a little bit more about the president too. Right. I just feel like there could have been some more character development in this, besides just the subtle innuendo and a little bit more about what's happening. But it's a fine line, like you said, because you don't want to, you want it to be like this could happen anywhere. You know, like, let's not get into the details of the politics, but it doesn't, maybe not even politics, just like, what has happened, you know, how can these people still live on these farms, you know?
Yeah,
why is there this town they go into and nothing, it's like nothing has happened, yet there's people, there's snipers on the roof.
Yeah,
like what,
like, I think because it's the episodic structure of it, it's meant to show you sort of like, as most of the movie is this travelogue where they're traveling from New York to Washington to sort of capture the final phase of this war. And I think that's intentional. I think the ethos of the movie is summed up in that scene where they are driving and they come to this like Santa's Village Winter Wonderland thing. And I mean, it's the middle of summer. So, but you know, to play into this, I think you're 100% right that there's like a complete lack of tension, because I knew that, I mean, when that scene began and they pull up and they're like, what's going on here? Like, do you see anything? And and there's like this mannequin in the middle of the road that's made to look like an injured or dead soldier. And like the meme of, you know, Mad Max Fury Road, that's bait. Like, flashed in my head. When you know, there's a sniper in the one of the buildings there, and they come across these two soldiers, like another sniper and a spotter, and you know, they pull up and they're, you know, like, "We're pressing," and you know, this guy's like so bitter, and Jay's like, "Yeah, I noticed, because it says press on the side of your car." And it's,
Yeah.
and you know, like, "Well, what are we doing?" He's like, "Well, we're trying not to get shot. We're shooting at him." And, "Well, what side are you on?" "Doesn't matter." And I think that's the whole ethos of the film, is just like, what side are you on? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This is just, you know, complete and utter, like, ruinous behavior. The thing about the president too, I think Garland kind of cauterizes that. There's this line where they're talking in the car, where they're talking about, like, what they expect the president to say, because they're going to DC to try and get, because the Offerman president hasn't given an interview in like years or something, and so they want to get an interview with him before the Western forces take the White House and execute him. And you know, Stephen McKinley Henderson says, like, you know, you're gonna find, like, when we get to the end of this journey, you're gonna find that this guy isn't as big and as gross and as scary as you think. And he mentions, like, Ceausescu and Mussolini, and I think that's another inherent message of the movie. It's like the big bad is inconsequential, because they're, you know, ultimately they're a scared little paper man hiding behind their desk and hiding behind an army, you know, sending out decoys so that they can try and escape. And it's never what you think it is. Whether it's like whatever the ideology is, whatever you're fighting for, like, it's all kind of, I guess, not a mirage. I don't know what I'm trying to say, what the exact word I'm trying to use, but it's like, it's all kind of like dressing to what the fact of the matter is. This is just chaos. This is just horror. This is just terrible. And I mean, like, you could say what you want about it, like, Garland's like sort of apolitical approach to a very political movie, but you know, I think his point of view is very clear. It's just like, this is horrible. Like, why did anyone want to be involved in this? Why would we want to, like, think 2 seconds about the importance of trying to capture this? Is just messed up. Or, I mean, like a lot of Garland movies, he's essentially saying, like, we're doomed as a species. And I think the politics are strangely ultimately secondary. And the other thing I will say too is, the Joel character, the Reuters reporter, he doesn't take a single note in the whole movie. Speaking as a reporter, I'm always taking notes. I have like three boxes with notebooks. So he's a journalist with a wire service. He's never taking notes. He's never filing copy.
I kind of had a problem with that character in general. It's like he's almost just there to be this charming guy or something. This,
It's
I,
yeah,
yeah.
it's I mean, that's if there's one thing that took me out of the movie, it is that he never takes any notes.
Yeah, like, yeah, they're taking all kinds of photographs, but you don't see that guy. Yeah, he's a journalist. He's not a,
Has
yeah,
a
he's doing,
vodka bottle. He doesn't have a notebook.
he's just drinking and driving. That's all he,
He
not,
was drinking and driving. You're right. That's the real crime of the movie.
yeah. I was saying drinking and drive, but I don't, yeah, he might have been, but yeah, he's just, it, yeah, that character had some, like, charisma. But it's like, he didn't really do a lot for me. Like, Kirsten Dunst, I think, as Lee Smith, was really good.
She's really good, yeah.
Kaylee Spaney as Jesse is good, but at the same time, you know, I felt like, you know, when they all get in the truck, it's like, is this like Little Miss Sunshine meets a political thriller or something? I don't know. It just seemed like everyone's going together in this truck to
To the
you
front
know.
line, yeah.
Yeah, conveniently they're all getting together to do this.
Well, she's a tiny woman, Kaylee Spaney, so I mean, they kind of use that to her to the advantage of the film, just like, you know, this one little person who wants to be a war photographer in the middle of all this madness. And
Yeah.
I did like the kind of the photo gear porn, where she's like, she's shooting on actual film, and how she like develops film in the field, and that's I did enjoy that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it does say something about almost like the morality of journalists too, right? It's like, okay, I have to take pictures even though, I'm seeing the most horrible things taking place.
And I mean, it's
You
part of
don't
the mythology of a lot of journalists too. I mean, Anderson Cooper famously like got on a plane and went to a war zone, and that was like his first reporting gig. So, I mean,
Yeah.
that's it happens. So.
Yeah, and Kirsten Dunst, yeah, she looks, as Lee Smith looks, like she's hardened the whole film. Like she's
Oh my
been through
God,
a lot of crap, a lot of crazy stuff she's seen, right? And you can tell she projects that really well.
She does. I mean, 30 years in the business. She's like 30. Like, Interview with a Vampire was 30 years ago, this year. So it's,
Yeah.
I
Maybe
mean,
Hollywood's done that to her.
I mean, yeah, that's what I'm just, with everybody talking about quiet on set and all that stuff, I'm thinking, I'm sure Kirsten Dunst has seen some things in her career, but we've seen some things on this show, and unfortunately, we always run out of time before we're done talking about them. But that's it for end credits this week. We hope you liked it. If you want to listen to our show again, you can download it every Friday from our website at endcreditsradioshow.com, or at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can get us through your favorite podcast app at Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for much of the music that you hear in end credits. Just open up Spotify and search for end credits on CFRU. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and we're on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will return next Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And Tim, where else can people find you out there on the internet?
On the internet, flashing the deadpan on social media, working on that those short stories with my writers group. So shout out to my writers group,
Nice.
Blackbird Writers Group and Junction Writers Group. So
Oh, yeah.
they give some good feedback. So eventually I'll have that out. Just wanna polish everything.
And as Tim polishes, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. This show will return next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.
Thank you.